there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking. I have to start right away prefacing that you have kind of a very big CV. What I found about you was very impressive. From first of all, being an award-winning integral investor and successful serial entrepreneur is what you've been called. Then you're a published author, recipient of the Golden Angelina Award. You were named an Entrepreneur of the Year by the European Business Angel Network. And you were also awarded full membership in the prominent International Club of Rome, which we also want to talk about later. And you can kind of elaborate on that. I don't know if everybody has heard of it before, but I do think it is quite prominent. So please let us know, maybe in your own words, in a little more personal way, if you things about you, name, occupation, background, and maybe if you want to share it also what you would describe as your purpose or passion.
My purpose, first of all, is to give hope to your generation and coming generations, given the state of the planet right now, and all the negative media and all the polarization of the society and all the crisis up and down that we're currently facing. I think it's extremely important that we keep having hope and get a sense of direction that we can do something about it and go away from disempowering ourselves and each other toward what can we do to really build the next generation of economics, of sectors of the society that are important to ensure the future of life, to support nature in regenerating itself, because we have come to a point in our global civilization and local civilization where the planet is kind of telling us that we can't continue in the same way. Not just the planet in terms of nature, but also the societies, you know, the culture that we have created that seems to thrive on bashing each other, criticizing each other, negativity. And so at least this is my perception, and my raison d'être or my purpose in life is to really show what's good and not what's wrong with us.
And what exactly got you to this point? Because I think I'm sure many people who hear this would agree with you and would resonate with that message and that purpose. But there are many people who maybe do not, who have difficulty maybe getting to that action stage and also identifying what are my particular skills, what is something that I can do to actually realize those dreams and ambitions that I have for the world. So what got you to that state, maybe also state of mind, which is the first step, I guess? How did you get there and find out what was your purpose, your niche, let's say, maybe in that field?
What got me started was my beginning in life. I was born and raised in communist Romania to a German mother and a Romanian father. They were both very, very poor. It was right after, you know, they were children of the war. They were in their teens when the Second World War broke out, and Romania was belonged to the losers of the war, and they didn't have an opportunity to go to school. They fell in love, and I was the result of it. But they were really, really, really poor. So I grew up in a society that emphasized education and emphasized equality in terms of, you know, communism is all about the commune in the party line, so to speak. What they did later, that was a different story. They didn't know how to implement those ideals, but originally this is the construct of society that was being implemented at the time I grew up. So the education system was very good, the emphasis on math and sciences. And so that was very empowering to me as somebody who went to school very often without food. But the belief that if I studied and I used the opportunity of free education, free healthcare, never mind that it was poor and all of that, but it was for free, available to everyone. And the idea that if we work hard on ourselves and with each other, then we will thrive. So that's how I grew up. And that was a means, the belief, and my parents empowered me in this belief because that's all we had. You know, I was starving. We didn't have much else. But the belief that if I study and if I take advantage of the great education that I had and the society that was trying to build itself anew, then we would leave that poverty. And so this is how I grew up with. And at age 16, my parents managed to leave Romania because my mother was German. And the German government was trying to encourage its own citizens that were living outside of Germany to come instead of, you know, hiring workers from, you know, that were not German. So they paid the Romanian government and Russian governments and others, you know, to let their own people leave. And so that's what brought us to Germany. And of course, with that, all of a sudden, the entire thing changed. And so the idea that I had everything in my hand in terms of empowering myself by studying and learning and trying to make sense of what was going on around me in a society that was free, which was the German society, that was a wonderful combination, which was empowering. So I ended up studying because I always loved math. I had excellent Romanian teachers, and I didn't grow up as a woman with the idea that because I was a woman, I was less smart than a boy, which is something that is I found to be prevalent in Germany. I didn't grow up with that mindset in Romania. It was equality, remember? So nobody told me, oh, you know, you're a girl, you should study humanities because you're not good at. The opposite was the case. So I think this belief system with which I grew up was very empowering, and the opportunities that I had, which we have in the free world, I think that was a wonderful combination to put me on a way that enabled me to really turn what I had between my two ears as the only wealth that I had, and the love from my parents and a society that was supportive, into an opportunity. So I think that's a long answer to a short question. But that led then in Germany to, you know, I finished high school here. I went to university because I wanted to study math. And it was about that time that computer science was being taught. I went to the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Karlsruhe, and I didn't particularly like programming in, you know, those strange languages like Pascal and COBOL and all of that. It was a weird way to think, and code knowledge. But it very soon I was faced with artificial intelligence and artificial intelligence technology and object-oriented programming and neural nets and all of that. That was also, it was leading edge at the time. I'm talking about early 80s. But I loved the way of programming in the way you think, or close to that. And so I began... I was very interested in applying artificial intelligence technology in chip design. That was my specialty, computer design, chip design, and that brought me to Stanford. So I became an exchange student at Stanford University because of my artificial intelligence interests, and so that was that set me up. Well, the timing was perfect because not only was artificial intelligence back then so up and coming and leading edge, and I met amazing people who were building all these technologies, you know, like AI machines, symbolics, you know, AI-based, artificial intelligence-based computers that symbolic, you know, could process in a symbolic way programs. But the internet was also coming, and so the timing for that kind of education, that kind of interest, was perfect because in the mid-90s, when finally the World Wide Web made the internet available, you know, with the first browser, that's when the exponential growth of technologies opened the whole world, you know, to what we have today.
From that setup, maybe you can just quickly say, how did your inspiration or drive come to say, I want to do good in my own way? I have this drive. I want to have a positive impact on the world. How did that come from that setup that you have, maybe that education that you saw as a window to like expressing yourself in the world and creating an impact?
Brilliant question, because when you are poor and don't have anything to eat, you're at the bottom of the Maslow pyramid. I don't know, are you familiar with the term Maslow pyramid?
Yes.
Abraham Maslow was a psychologist, and he looked at what changes people's mindsets. How do people evolve? And there are many psychologists, many philosophers who've done that, but he is one that became very famous within the business world. And so that's the Maslow pyramid. So at the bottom of it, you have to fulfill your basic needs, you know, like food and shelter. And then the next would be, you know, once you have that, you're ready to, you know, join a family, you know, be safe in your family, in your own small social construct. And then once that's given, then you are opening up to the society in the larger context, an ethnocentric, tribal way. And then if that is fulfilled and everything is good, then you move to the next, where you open up to, oh my God, my village, my city, my country is not the only one. The next opening up of or growth of mindset is the world. Oh my God, I am at home in the world and I can do something for the world. And so I took all these steps, which are very important if you were to, like you said, put yourself in service of humanity. You have to fulfill your basic needs, because if you don't, you're busy, you know, making a living. And because I was so blessed, you know, to live in the free world, have the best education, so the basic of my Maslow pyramid needs were fulfilled. However, the idea of wanting to leave, to get out of poverty, was very important to me, you know, with the only capital that I had. That was, you know, what I had between my ears. And so of course, when my husband and I, that was in the mid-90s, we saw that the internet was coming. We saw that as an opportunity to really become entrepreneurs. And so we started our first company in Silicon Valley, and we came then to Germany, wanted to bring the internet to, you know, companies that would have wanted a presence on the internet, to help them do that, only to find out that in Germany nobody knew what is the internet. Why do you need that? Isn't the telecom doing it? All these questions, because nobody saw the exponential growth of that technology as the foundation for the next level of society. And so I kept doing technology transfer from Silicon Valley, and my husband started, I invested, we went to fools, friends and family and raised a couple hundred thousand dollars, and he started the first internet service provider to help people get access to the internet. So that turned out to be the first internet service provider, so that gave people access to the internet. And it was the first internet stock that went public on the German Stock Exchange. So all of a sudden, you know, we worked hard, you know, wanted to become an entrepreneur. This is what you do when you're in Silicon Valley, blah, blah, you're a computer scientist. And all of a sudden, we had left poverty, so to speak. At least from my perspective, he didn't come from the same background. But, and so all of a sudden, I saw the schizophrenia in our system. I saw, on one hand, we had this IPO, you know, IPO is initial public offering, going to Wall Street, you know, we had made a lot of money, and, you know, together with others. And on the other hand, I saw my parents and how I was brought up and the poverty that was everywhere else outside of Germany, outside of the Western world. And my parents were simple workers, and I learned from them what it means to be a philanthropist, which doesn't mean anything else but love of people. And how do you manifest love to people is by helping them, you know, by doing something good for the people. So from the little that they had earned, every on a regular basis, they went to Romania and gave to those who had much, much less. And so on one hand, we had this IPO and money in Wall Street. And on the other, I saw this poverty and I saw the schizophrenia in the system. So all these people on Wall Street, and I looked at much, much richer people, you know, like all the big ones, you know, Carnegie and Stanford and all the, you know, Warren Buffett's of the world and blah, 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 who all had foundations. So on one hand, you go to Wall Street, make a ton of money, and then you start a foundation to give away, which of course is sick from my perspective, is a good way to do good, but I saw that the system is crazy. So because when you look into the capital that foundations manage in order to give away to people, in reality they give less than 5% of the capital of the foundation to people. The rest goes back to Wall Street. And so to me that was, something's got to give here. It just doesn't make sense. So this is where my mindset all of a sudden shifted to, I've got to do something about this.
Yeah. This is so interesting, and in that you mentioned it, like that your that shift in perspective also came from a desire to change something in that system because it was so crazy and insane, which I completely agree with. And this podcast is also very much about systemic changes, obviously, because so many other changes, they're all nice and fine, but if you don't get to the root of the problem, you will always be just kind of walking around that same puddle without ever getting to the very ground of it. So you are in a position where you have experienced both communism and capitalism and these very different cultures and ways of thinking, ways of living. And I think that's interesting because I'm sure a lot of people listening have only experienced capitalism. I mean, it's something most of us identify with. Capitalism is culture. We don't notice that it is that, but we identify with it as humans and sometimes think there is no other way. But since you have had something very different and experienced that, and you've talked about this, I want to know from you your thoughts on conscious capitalism, quote unquote. Do you think it is possible? Because often the question that I also ask people and economists that have come on the podcast is the question of, do you think for real change we can change within that system, that existing system, and make radical changes? Or is there a need for a new system? Or is a conscious capitalism possible in your opinion?
That's a very loaded question, particularly if we do not define the terms. What is capitalism? And what is consciousness? And what is conscious capitalism? Just to give you an example, I am sure you and I are conscious that we're having a conversation right now. Which doesn't mean anything that is aware. We're aware that we're sitting at this table talking to one another and we are in a certain context, right? We don't have any needs. We have the luxury to sit down here and philosophize about the world, right? Which presupposes, and it's probably true with that presupposition, that we are rather high on the Maslow pyramid that I just defined. So we're not in survival mode. This building is not shaking because it's an earthquake. It's warm in here, although outside is rather cool. We are, you know, our stomachs are full. You know, you had the luxury to come here and visit with me. We sit down. And we are aware of that. But who is aware? who we there are two people at the rather high at the self-actualization level on the Maslow pyramid. That means that whatever we do with our money is informed by that level of consciousness, rather high. Capitalism is, in its many manifestations, is always a reflection of the people who are dealing with it from their own level of consciousness. So when your mindset, and I'll use the Maslow pyramid as because this is a very complicated topic, and we won't be able to come up with good solutions if we do not understand the topic very well. So when you are at the bottom of the pyramid, and which is survival mode, right? And how do you deal with capital? I mean, money. Capital is nothing else but money in the very general sense. Most people, if you ask them what is capital, they'll tell you it's money, right? Then they will make sure that that money at that level, at survival level, becomes more. So they will do everything and anything to ensure the survival, that they will never, and I can speak to it because I grew up in that. You know, you have your wishes. I was a young girl, and my parents, you know, I went to school without food because we didn't have any. So when you grow up in this and you see all this scarcity, then you really do everything and anything. So that's conscious capitalism at that level, right? It's a very egocentric level of conscious capitalism, right? At the next level, let's say you have a job, you've grown up as a young girl, you know, you get a job, you are ready to get married. So you moved up a little bit from that survival. So you're looking for somebody who's, you know, also have a job, you know, has an education, you can get an apartment or and so on in a certain safe city, blah, blah. So that's conscious capitalism at the ethnocentric, tribal, you know, within the village, within the city, that's still conscious capitalism. So you're conscious about how you deal with your capital, right? That's conscious capitalism at the ethnocentric level of consciousness. Now, let's say all of a sudden, like us, you know, you have an IPO because you're smart, you go to school, have a great idea, your husband and I, you know, your husband and you and you, a few friends start a company because it's freedom and you have a little capital available, and that company goes public to the stock exchange. All of a sudden, you're a conscious capitalist in an ethnocentric environment and you have all this additional capital. Well, all of a sudden you say, oh my God, I have this house and then I have this other apartment and I gave my mother this car or my father the car and my mother the, you know, as a present, you know, something else. And I, you know, donated money to a shelter in the city, blah, blah, blah. But you still have so much more capital so that, you know, you open up and say, oh my God, what else can I do? You know, I may be, you know, investing in art. I may start a, you know, a museum. And but then you see that you only wear one piece of clothing at the time. You only need one roof over your head at one time. And all the abundance in terms of material things doesn't really make a big difference in your life, right? Except when you go to people and you give money to somebody, or you, in our case, you know, I had many, many kids from, you know, that I sent to school. We, you know, from many parts of the world, India, China, Eastern Europe. And all of a sudden, the fulfillment comes from looking into somebody's eyes and see how happy they are. And you have played a minuscule role in their happiness. So all of a sudden, your heart opens. And you move to the next level of consciousness, a more world-centric. It's not just about you and your tribe, it's about us together. Or if you like animals, then you see, oh my God, you know, I can really make a difference in life in general. And then all of a sudden you see, oh my God, you read an article, the Club of Rome you know, wrote 50 years ago that if we continue to use up the resources of the planet, you know, in a limited, you know, on a limited planet, then we'll have to bear the consequences, because resources are not limited, unlimited, on a limited planet, of course. So you all of a sudden open up to a world-centric mindset, and that would be conscious capitalism at a world-centric mindset. So the conversation about conscious capitalism is always dependent upon who's talking. So you have to look behind the scene, behind the, because everyone has a different understanding, you know, with respect to the same words. So you see conscious capitalism, you think, oh, it's about my tribe, Bavaria. Let's make Bavaria, whatever, beautiful. The others, you know, no, let's make China beautiful. No, America first, right? But then we don't realize that we all breathe the same air. You know, we all drink the same water, that the fresh air doesn't stop in Bavaria. You know, it goes over to Czech Republic or to Romania, and we drink the same water. You know, we're all humans, and the skin color doesn't really make a difference. So that is the conversation about conscious capitalism, to look behind. And then all of a sudden you see that, oh, capital means, can mean human capital, which is important. You know, how do I make more money? Well, by empowering people, for instance. How do I make more money? By making sure that the resources that I use from the planet, you know, are sustainable, you know, sustainably applied, so that future generations can. And all of a sudden you enlarge, you know, you see more, your mindset expands, and you see that we're all one. That's why the universe is called Universe, one song.
I think this is exactly these type of conversations that I want to have on the podcast. These are these conversations where after this, people could pause the podcast and sit back and then just say, okay, this just gave me something to think about. And also the fact that, this is also what I like, that you opened that up, because all of these words, for example, like conscious, like sustainable, whatever these words are that are big buzzwords that people use for all of these things, as you said, it might mean something completely different to your neighbor. And if your neighbor were put in their position to work towards, let's say, a sustainable economy, that neighbor would do it completely differently than you, or the neighbor one street further down. And so it's a completely different concept. And also, I am very sure that for you, money, the concept of money, spending money, how you make it, has a completely different, first of all, emotion for you towards it, and kind of what role it plays in your life, than it does for me or for somebody else on the street if we would ask them. So I love that, and I think this would be a good place for everybody to pause and maybe even jot down a few notes to think, if I think of conscious capitalism, what does it mean for me, and what do I think maybe it should be? And maybe even compare notes if you have somebody else listening to this. So that was very thought-provoking. I loved what you just said. Also using that pyramid is, I think, very interesting. So on that same note of capital, money, how, in your opinion, is there a way to integrate people, planet, and then also, or even if there is a way, profit? Because people and planet, basically they can exist without profit. We know that. People could go back to growing food. People could, if everybody would go back to living as, for example, indigenous communities live, or how our ancestors used to live, we wouldn't need money. Money is not a necessity for life on Earth. So the fact is, there is profit, there are economies, or there's profit that companies want to make, or people, individuals want to make. So do you think there's a way to integrate that, as you said, we're on a planet with finite resources, and we have reached our limit of wealth in the societies that are very wealthy. There is no more going up, there's only going down in the way we're doing it now. So do you think there is a way to integrate profit into the people and planet?
Of course it is. Otherwise you wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have agreed to this conversation, particularly because my motto is the six P's. The parity, which is the equality at the same level of importance between people, planet, prosperity with passion and purpose. So these are the six P's. It's the motto that guides my raison d'être on this planet. Why am I here? What am I doing? What does that mean? I would challenge you on the statement that we don't need profit. The reason why I do this is because people who say that haven't thought why we had to invent money if it wasn't important. And if you think about it, as societies evolved, and this is why we, you know, humans evolve, this is what life does. We evolve from simpler, remember the Maslow pyramid, simple forms of life, of society, to the next level of complexity. And it's ingrained in our biology, right? Which means, well, we're very complex, very extreme. We don't even understand how the complexity of being human, right? So as now, not from the biological perspective, but from a cultural perspective, as the society evolved, the necessity to have a means of exchange showed up, because you would raise tomatoes, I would have potatoes, and in order for us to be able, for you to buy shoes and me to buy flowers, we needed a different means, because otherwise we would have to keep selling potatoes against tomatoes and shoes against flowers and so on. So the invention of money was the result of evolution of culture. And profit has taken a negative connotation because people don't really think in depth about what it means. Profit means I have a little bit more money, so I grew too many potatoes and you grew too many tomatoes, and we exchanged them and we ended up with the symbol of tomatoes and potatoes, which is money. And you didn't use it all, so that was there was a surplus that you had at the end of whatever the season, and that is called profit. So you benefited from that work that you provided, right? And from that work, that surplus, you decided to give to your daughter, you know, a pair of new shoes, because that was the profit made it possible, right? Or whatever. What we're struggling with right now in this world that has become so much more complex ever since we stopped, you know, where we started to deal with money, is that we made the symbol of tomatoes, the money, we elevated that to a god. It's much more important than anything else. It's much more important than people. It's much more important than the tomatoes. It's much more important. So it's all money, 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 money. And we stop thinking about why we need that much. It's just, so we became unconscious. And out of this unconsciousness, we created the financial system that separates profit from everything else. And this is where the problem is. So if you, just to give you everyone who listens an example, you come to me and I'm an investor and say, Mariana, I have this great idea and I want to start this company and I need money to do that. Of course, because, you know, otherwise you'd have to raise tomatoes and potatoes. And then I will ask you, well, what kind of company are you trying to do? And so the first choice that you have to make as an entrepreneur is not, oh, I want to make sure that all the people on this planet get fed well, right? So this is my goal in life, right? Just like Bill Gates wanted to have everyone to, should have a computer. That was his thing, right? And you say, well, I want to make sure that everyone on this planet gets fed. Wow, how amazing. And I said, okay, well, in our financial system, in our economic system, what is the first decision that you have to make as an entrepreneur?
Well, probably what I want to do, like what I want my impact to be, what I want the purpose of my company or whatever I'm doing. You know, I have to make a decision, what do I want my entrepreneurial thing to be?
That's wrong. Do you know why?
No.
Because the system doesn't care about that. The system, the first decision that you have to make, is it a for-profit or a not-for-profit organization?
Mm.
And here is where the problem starts.
Yeah.
Why you have to become schizophrenic from the very beginning? So you come to me, and of course, as an integral investor, that's exactly what I want to hear from you. Why do you want to do that? And of course, I would give you the money and I would support you as much as I can because you mean it. But the system doesn't. System doesn't care. They only care like, oh, you decide, is it all for profit or not for profit? And so that forces everyone involved to become schizophrenic. Why? Because those who say, oh, it's a for profit are already labeled, oh, you know, it's all about money. She doesn't really care. And the other guy says, it's a not for profit. Oh, I am better than the one who wants to start a for-profit. So this is this screwed up schizophrenic society that we have created just because the system is so outdated. Okay? So what is happening right now, the not-for-profit person thinks who thinks is better. It's an NGO. Oh my God, I'm so superior. And I'm exaggerating so that to make the point. So
yeah.
Please don't, you know, I want everybody to have fun here. You know, say, oh, it's an NGO and, you know, I'm doing fundraising. And, but where do you go to fundraise? To those who have it, right? To have the money. So they think they are better, but they're actually competing with one another against, you know, for the money of the people that they're actually detesting. And, you know, so they're not cooperating, they're competing, going to these whatever, you know, foundations or whatever you do fundraising for an NGO, and compete with against each other. No, I have the business, I have the better, da-di-da-di-da. And forgetting that the foundation is only giving 5% away to not-for-profits, and 95% investing them on Wall Street again in a system that is totally outdated and no longer so because the system is actually exploiting all the resources, people, planet, everything else that we have, right? So, and the same is here, the same thing is true for the for-profit organization, because they, you know, they cannot, nobody who comes, you know, let's say you want to feed everybody on the planet, but you decide to do a for-profit organization. Why? Because you don't want to deal with this entire fundraising and waste your time in fundraising. You want to, you know, feed the people, right? So you decide, in this structure, economic, financial system that we have, I've decided to have a for-profit organization. And then you come to me or go to other investors and say, well, here's a for-profit. But now you have to show me, oh, the business plan and how do you want to raise the profits? Are you delivering a 10x? Is that a unicorn? And, you know, so the entire conversation goes on the other side of schizophrenia, right? So to come back to your question, the system is a reflection of our underdeveloped levels of consciousness. Mm-hmm. That's what needs to change. So as long as I have to make a binary decision, I'm creating a stupid binary society. I'm creating schizophrenia because if I do for profit, I have to extend, you know, profit maximization at the expense of everything else. So what we need is an integration thereof. That's why for me is the 6P, the parity. So money is as good as what I do with it, right? It's the same with technology. Technology can be good, can be bad. It's about the people who apply it. It's not, you know. And of course, you know, we're all in the same boat. You know, you cannot, I mean, you can lie to me right now, but you need to realize that you're actually lying to yourself. Okay? Because we're all in the same boat. In on a round planet, there is no choosing upsides. And so that's why my purpose in life is to really help people see what's wrong with the system and try to change it if possible. And this is what I'm all about. Or find good ways to work around it until the system itself is mm-hmm. being forced mm-hmm. to change. Just like the financial crisis is forcing us to do, the planet is talking to us, forcing us to change the ways we are and so on.
I like that you have all these different thoughts that are, as I said, it's supposed to be thought-provoking, and thank you very much for challenging me on that point, which is also the whole point. I don't want this podcast to be like I'm asking questions and then it's like a yes and amen type of situation. You know, we can also have different opinions, we can have we should have discourse, because that's where the big ideas come from. Because another person might be listening to this and saying, I've been in my bubble, but now I hear something Mariana is saying and I'm thinking there's new information here, what does that maybe spark in my head? And then that's the only way we keep expanding our horizon. Otherwise, we just stay in the same thing and we listen to things or read things that just affirm what we already know, and that obviously doesn't make any sense if you want to evolve. As we've talked about evolving, as you've said on this pyramid, obviously people have evolved, and this is, I mean, it's a fact that we right now, we have a higher IQ than our grandparents, than their parents before. It's just, you know, humanity keeps getting smarter, generally IQ-wise, dumber maybe in other ways. You can argue about that as well. And I like that you challenged me on that point with the prophet, because my thinking there is always, as I talked about indigenous communities and also the story, I don't know if you know the nonprofit Local Futures, the founder is Helena Norberg Hodge. I also worked for them, and that's basically the story of the community called the Ladakh, who live in Tibet, and they basically had this beautiful economy of happiness, what Helena calls it, which is need-based. It's need-based, but people there still have a community where there's dancing, singing, where there are maybe intellectual pursuits, but they have everything. They grow everything there. They live, obviously, not as we do in houses with electricity, TVs and such, but they had everything. They were happy people. They have holistic medicines, so they know how to take care of themselves. And Helena basically lived with them and learned from them and experienced this beautiful culture. And then, as in most parts of the world, tourism and globalization also came to that part of the world and completely destroyed the culture and completely destroyed them. And a few years later, when she came back, people, everything was dirty. The whole mindset of people had changed. And people who had never known or used the word poor before suddenly said, help us, we are poor. You know, we need business, we need an economy because we are poor. But they weren't poor before the rest of globalization and kind of this thinking of, or this need for profit came there. Then it all changed. So that is kind of my thinking when I say for survival on this planet, we don't need profit. You know, natural processes don't need profit in nature. But I do agree with you. If people would ask me, do you want to live, you know, in in an indigenous community, for example, for the rest of their life, I think many of us, we would obviously be thinking, you know, we want to travel the world. There are things we want to see. Some people are excited about technology. And I think once, as you said, we have evolved and we are in touch with so many different things, with different information, and we want that. We want to do all of that. And I think that is the thing where maybe my view of what profit is and if we need it or not is not completely correct. And maybe other people would say, but I don't really like Mariana's answer either completely, you know? And this is exactly the conversation that I want to have. So thank you for elaborating on that a lot. And I'm going to leave this a little bit open-ended as well. This is, again, we're not coming to a conclusion. Is my answer right or your answer wrong? So people can just decide for themselves, do I have something new to think about? Now,
maybe just a comment on this, because I completely agree with you. In terms of having a vision for the future where this indigenous mindset is combined, you know, like no money and all the needs being met, is combined with technology and future and visiting the world and visiting the planet. Something that we need to develop. It's, I think for now, we can only identify what needs to be changed. I don't think we do have the answers. And we never will, because evolution, that's what evolution does. It evolves.
Yeah.
And we will never give up, you know, wanting new things.
Yeah.
That's just human nature.
Definitely.
And it's beautiful. That's why we're here. And we should avoid idolizing, because the moment we idolize, we distance ourselves from reality on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's only a question of, you know, of time. You know,
when
you're happy, the next moment you start to wish and want something else.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.